Welcome to our Sunday morning meeting. The month of October is devoted to universal theosophy, which is a really strange thing to say because every month here is devoted to universal theosophy. But this opening month of our fall, winter, spring season is devoted to the basic ideas of the philosophy of theosophy. And you will see if you've picked up a schedule that next month is the synthesis of science and religion, and then in December we have cycles of life. So there are many, many interesting things. On Sunday mornings, we open at 10:30, and the meeting is from 11 to 12. On Wednesdays, we have a reference library from 5:15 to 7:15, and then a class in the Ocean of Theosophy from 7:30 to 8:30. Of course, all of our meetings are free, and everyone is welcome to attend and participate, even if that participation is only listening. There's powers unrecognized by all of us, powers of the soul, and sincere listening and appreciating adds to and assists everyone in the room. So don't ever think you're doing nothing just by paying attention. We call your attention to the declaration on the back of the program. It is the same policy for every lodge, no matter where in the world it is located, no matter what language it conducts its classes in. And you can see from the list, it is all over the world. The basic, I think I woke up without my vocabulary this morning, but we'll make do. The basic premise of this declaration is that it is independent devotion to the cause of universal brotherhood, to the cause of theosophy, the realization that all life is one, and that to the extent that we desire to be part of this, we are welcome. There's no distinctions made as to gender or condition or religious belief or religious background or educational background. Everyone is equal in the eyes of theosophy. And as one realizes through studying, the person that you think may be, quote, less educated, less knowledgeable, less wise about philosophy than you, may just be in a very temporary karmic condition and may actually be light years ahead of you. So judge no one. It is the goal of ULTs and the students who do the work to keep the true ideas of theosophy before the world. We're students. We give out to the best of our ability, but the biggest duty that we have is to direct people to the same materials that we study, the original writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. The student does the best the student can do. The material is always there for anyone to peruse. The work that is done here then, obviously, is done on a voluntary basis. And the support for the lodge itself, and as we all know, daily that support need increases, things just are getting so expensive. That, again, is voluntary. We don't pass the hat. We don't have fees or dues. It is up to each individual to give to support this work as they see fit. Now, our title this morning is a very, very interesting one, The Worldview of Theosophy. We will have that subject presented, and then there'll be time for questions and discussion.
One of man's basic needs is to know, to understand, to find meaning. He must have answers, especially, I lost my way, especially answers to life's fundamental questions, if he is to be whole. Is there design and purpose in nature? Does man's life have any meaning in itself, apart from the meanings or purposes he imposes on it? Are there any values built into the scheme of things? Values inherent in nature, not only in a given human culture. Does one survive death? Questions such as these have been asked by men for centuries and are still being asked today. The answers to such questions are harder to find today in our modern world than they were in past cultures. Today, there are so many conflicting answers in various religions and philosophic groups. In past cultures, in our world of the past, most learned men agreed upon the basic principles on which the universe is established. And those principles have sometimes been an integral part of the culture as a whole, woven into the fabric of the life of the people. A thread of truth has appeared repeatedly throughout history, sometimes taught openly and dominating a culture, as in ancient Greece, at other times taught in secret to those few who sought after it. The principles have been styled differently, and various aspects have been emphasized at different times, but the fundamentals have remained unchanged. The core of understanding, or undying tradition, is known as theosophy, divine wisdom, a term which dates back to Alexandria's era of greatness. It is often called occult or esoteric, because it is concerned not with the obvious or superficial, but with what is hidden or essential. It deals with nature's unseen processes and laws, with that which stands behind and religion and beyond science. The founders of all the great religions have taught aspects of this doctrine, and strains of it remain in all modern religions, though often buried by misinterpretations which have accumulated through the ages. Yet it is markedly modern and in tune with today's search for a worldview to integrate the overwhelming burst of knowledge in the past couple centuries. This philosophy is an integrated system of thought, upholding certain definite principles. It was presented to the modern world mainly through the works of H.P. Blavatsky, whose magnum opus, The Secret Doctrine, was first published in 1888. She did not claim to have written anything original, but rather to have brought together and restated for the West some of the ancient teachings which had appeared throughout the centuries at different times and places. She drew on original sources of every major religion and the science and philosophy of the principal cultures of East and West to corroborate the presence of the core of theosophy throughout the ages of man's history. The key ideas found in the Secret Doctrine may be simplified as three basic principles. The first principle is central to the theosophical system, the axis around which all else turns. There is one living, non-material, creative, homogeneous reality for from which everything in the universe has sprung. According to this concept, all nature is immersed in one essential life. All creatures are its reflections. All the complex unfoldment of the universe through evolution is the outworking of principles which adhere to this background reality. All nature is its expression. It shines through the stone, the star, the saint, and the sinner alike. In the words of H.P. Blavatsky, the one prevailing, most distinct idea found in all ancient teachings with reference to cosmic evolution is that the whole cosmos has sprung from the divine thought. This thought impregnates matter, which is co-eternal with the one reality, and all that lives and breathes evolves from the emanations of the one immutable, the eternal one root. In the world religions, this reality is called by different names: Brahma, the Tao, and God. This concept of an underlying divine principle is common to most of the great religions. Lao Tzu says, it was from the nameless that heaven and earth sprang. Shankara, the great Indian sage, puts the idea of the context of Hinduism. The Atman is that by which the universe is pervaded, but which nothing pervades, which causes all things to shine, but which all things cannot make to shine. The idea of unity, so common in Oriental religion and literature, has been prevalent in the West from time to time. Plato and the Neoplatonists taught the concept. In the words of Plotinus, each being contains in itself the whole intelligible world. Therefore, all is everywhere. Each is therefore all, and all is each. The Christian Bible states, in him we live and move and have our being. Eastern religions have always viewed divine reality as an impersonal, universal life pervading nature. The essential brotherhood of all men necessarily stems from the idea of one divine source for all. This is a fundamental concept of the theosophical philosophy. In H.P. Blavatsky's time, when theosophers were working for the recognition of brotherhood, an attitude of separateness and a sense of the superiority of the white race were dominant in the Christian world. But the stresses of the 20th and 21st century are forcing a recognition of the indivisibility of the family of man. We know through bitter experience that a shot fired in Southeast Asia or in Africa will reverberate around the world, that the destinies of the nations are inextricably intertwined. We have learned that the sufferings of any minority group are of concern to the whole of society. Improved travel and communications have made cooperation essential among people and nations everywhere. This worldwide scope of the network of relationships is a new development in history, and it is forcing the acceptance of the principle of brotherhood, the essential oneness of all humanity, and the necessity for mutual respect and concern among all peoples. Although this theosophical idea is far from being realized fully in the world today, it is slowly gaining ground. The idea of essential unity implies also that all nature is interrelated and that man is part of it. Cycles, which are periodic manifestations for all, under law, this proposition states that all things, visible and invisible, all of nature, all worlds and all universes come and go through the laws of cycles or periodicity. The same law of cycles seen throughout nature expresses itself in death, rest, and rebirth for man. An individual having countless lives in many races and cultures, sometimes as a man, sometimes as a woman, in many walks of life. Just as subhuman forms improve and provide a basis for enhanced consciousness through evolution, man's mind, emotions, and body slowly improve through eons of time, many lives, and banking many experiences, so that he is able to actualize new dimensions of the divine life. There is an ancient view held by well over half the people in the world today that there is a cycle of reincarnation for man, and there is a cycle of flowering and latency for trees. Further, according to theosophical philosophy, the interests, relationships, abilities of one lifetime will reverberate in future lives according to the law of karma or cause and effect. Mental and emotional forces set in motion for good or ill must inevitably react upon the individual at some future time in some life. The gifts and handicaps of a lifetime are the result of the ways in which energies have been used in the past, and they bring opportunities or frustrations to the individual's deeply buried urge to actualize his possibilities. All cycles are dependent and interdependent, especially two cycles that can't exist without each other, the cycles of karma and reincarnation. And the third was evolution. The world, in the ancient view, is an emanation of boundless space, which far from being a featureless void, is a fullness, a continuum with properties which give rise to matter and energy, consciousness, and life. The initial impulse which sets this emanation in motion causes the long processes of differentiation of what we call evolution. This process will continue until the final phase of growth, both physical and spiritual, is reached. According to H.P. Blavatsky, the secret doctrine teaches the progressive development of everything, worlds as well as atoms. And this stupendous development has neither conceivable beginning nor imaginable end. The whole scheme is moving through the development of increasingly complex forms, which unfold even richer expressions of consciousness. H.P. Blavatsky says, the whole order of nature evinces a progressive march towards a higher life. From the theosophical standpoint, mankind today is far from mature in an evolutionary sense, but the whole stream of evolution is pushing him forward, sometimes gently, sometimes with force. And though time will release more and more of the powers locked within him, theosophy sees mankind as a whole slowly moving and becoming more effective, more creative, more loving, so that future man will be as far above us as we are now, far beyond the caveman. Theosophy does not offer shortcuts or a panacea to solve the difficult and complex problems of our times, of our world, but it does give a hopeful, long-range view of eventual fulfillment for all people. Its concepts reestablish purpose and meaning in the universe and in man, and give one a firm foundation on which to build one's life. These ideas call out the deep, partially unconscious urge within each person to move on, to grow, to release his potentials in productive work. And as he takes his life in hand towards this end, he comes to feel and understand more and more within himself the essential truth of these timeless ideas and their directive powers in his life. Though life will not necessarily become easier, he will come to know the incomparable rewards of aligning his life with the Creator's, with the creative source of being, and moving forward consciously within the evolutionary stream. And to refresh your memory, the talk today, The Worldview of Theosophy.
On the book table, we have put two pamphlets. HBB's Transcendental Theosophy, and the article in there is World Deliverance, and another article is How Do We Help Our Fellow Man? And then a pamphlet by Mr. Judge, The Theosophical Movement. It includes an article, The Theosophical Movement, The Future, with stress laid upon America, and then a sign of the cycle, again, with stress related upon America. Now, we would like to see if perhaps we could take the worldview of theosophy and relate it to ourselves, our own worldview, because that's what the worldview means, the basis upon which you act, think, grow, and learn. So if we could take those ideas that were presented and see how we can use them in a practical way, how do they affect us? Yes?
Well, we noticed on the declaration it states the policy, which is the dissemination of the three fundamental ideas, and then right afterwards the term independent devotion.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we were not independent, what would we be? Dependent. Dependent on someone or something to tell us what to do. So it is just another way of saying it is up to the individual soul to study and learn, apply these ideas as they can, and grow and learn in the process. It is independent. It isn't following what anyone tells you, you must think, you must believe. It is to grow within yourself in that realization. Yes?
Another worldview is that all the disturbances and conflict that we see within the world are created or are simply results of ideas that have been prevalent for centuries. Idea of karma and reincarnation can be understood in that process as we see through history, where the ideas don't change and they expect a different result, and they keep on doing the same thing.
Isn't that true of all of us, though?
Yes. But karma shows us what we need to do. It comes right to us, and the only way we can deal with it is if we have some kind of theosophical education. Knowing that it's just a result, if we personalize it, then we have a problem, and we struggle with it.
And we keep repeating it, yeah. Yes. That's absolutely a necessary worldview, to realize it is a universe that operates under law. We may not be able to figure out how we created the problem we have, but we have to honor the fact that it is our problem, and we have to fix it. We have to fix ourselves. Yes? You'll have to speak up.
We do like that term, dissemination of the fundamental ideas, because it brings to mind that we sow seeds in people's minds, and they have to independently discover what they will
Right.
So it's freedom of choice that we inherit.
The awful thing for all of us at the same time, it's the most wonderful thing for all of us, is we are always free. We are free to will and choose and think, reach our own conclusions and act on that basis. The reason that's horrible is we are usually enamored with what's going on the personal material world with our selfish ideas. When if we would take hold of these spiritual ideas, we would grow in ways we can't even imagine. But to go back for a moment to the Declaration, it says that the work it has on hand is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy. Now, that's not the fundamental propositions. The fundamental principles are, of course, universal brotherhood, the fact that it is a universe of law. They coordinate with the propositions, but the fundamental principles are not basically those three ideas. It is up to the individual, if they want to really understand the philosophy, to concentrate and focus on those three ideas that were presented in the talk. The fact of deity being a principle, not a being. The fact that it is a universe of law, that karma is or cause and effect, is the expression of that principle in action. And then evolution, that all growth comes from within. But the principles and the propositions, while they honor each other, are not exactly the same thing. So we don't expect people beginning in the philosophy to understand and be able to speak about the propositions, those fundamental propositions, but we do expect them to understand universal brotherhood, law in action, and growth, evolution. Now we've silenced you, I'm sorry. Yes.
Well, another worldview perspective, with this very first principle, we begin to realize that all life is alive, and it is moving. It's moving in the direction we see all the kingdoms, they sacrifice themselves for the next kingdom, and it just slowly moves forward. And this is part of that first principle, and that we see in the people of the world that there is spirit there. There's something more than that physical body. And we see cultures reaching for something greater than just a simple material existence. You know, we're bombarded with the negatives of life, but in fact, for the negatives, there are that much positive as well. But we don't see that because it's oftentimes hidden.
When often we focus on the negative. If you stop and take a given news program, how much time is given to anything positive? Very, very little, because it doesn't sell magazines, it doesn't sell advertising. And this is the sad part, we're responsible for that. It is what the consumer wants that the consumer ends up getting. And it's a duty of all of us to help elevate the thinking and desires around us. We know a teacher who taught in high school critical thinking. When did anybody ever teach you how to critically think? How to look at an ad and see, what is it trying to make me do? What does it want me to do? Do I need that? Do I even want that? Why is this slanted this way? We have to begin to look at all ideas and presentations because it is our worldview. Yes, in the back. We saw a poster once. You are the unique representative of sameness. And it's true. which means we have a responsibility. It also said at the bottom of that poster, revolution only changes the names of everything. Evolution is the answer. So we have to do the work on ourselves. We have to examine our worldview. What do we think and believe, and why do we think it and believe it? Because we were told by our parents, and we trust them and we love them. Well, they didn't know any better. Because we were taught it in school, or our religion states this, we have to pull it all apart. If we find it is good and wise, we keep it. If we find that we've outgrown it, we lovingly put it aside and replace it with something closer to reality. Yes?
The process being described is a devotional one because it's never ending.
Yes.
You know, just when we think we've realized something about one of our premises, all of a sudden it flips over and we say, oh, wait a minute, that's not quite right either. So a sense of humor is a good companion to have in this process.
I think HPB says it's the most necessary. But then Mr. Judge says it would be a contest of smiles if we knew our business. In other words, here you are, a spiritual being with all the powers that you see in the universe, and you're trapped in these little narrow ideas in this particular body and circumstances, and you think that's it. That's the whole of you. That's the whole of possibilities, and that's what keeps us trapped, is because we do think that. We do believe that. If we were to take a few minutes every day just to question that, we would begin to free our mind by degrees. Mr. Judge's great line, realization comes from dwelling on the thing to be realized. Why? How is that possible? That sounds effortless. How is that possible? Realization comes from dwelling on the thing to be realized. Yes.
Well, dwelling is concentration.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I mean, you live in a dwelling, you're there. It's kind of like you're living in the idea and making it real as you can.
And it is real. And because it's real, it has an effect on you. In other words, the next time you go to dwell on that idea, it's expanded some. It's like brooding. You familiar with the word brooding? It's like, yes, it's like sitting on an egg and hatching it. We are sitting on the egg of our own realization, and we are dwelling in it. You're absolutely right. It is a privilege and a responsibility. Yes. It's a good thing we don't have three or four, isn't it?
So, we discover we're to apply these ideas to ourselves independently. But our system of public education rewards you for getting A's and B's and passing tests and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And when we discover all of that we are getting will not help us understand these ideas unless, as you said, we go over them logically in our own mind and apply them to ourselves.
Well, what usually happens is someone reaches a point where everything they have available to them in their education, in their religion, in whatever concepts they have will not answer the case in front of them. It's either tremendous suffering or tremendous questioning of the suffering of others. So every soul in every life has at least a moment or two where they could possibly stop and question. What keeps us from it? What do you think keeps someone who has an idea about the universality of law? What do you think keeps someone from taking hold of that idea and using it?
Well, the quality of Thomas or inertia.
Yes.
That desire to change, but how do I do that?
Yeah, how is it possible?
How is it possible?
And there's also fear. We're afraid of change often. Yes.
And then sometimes it's just the process of waiting, of procrastinating. That one path may seem a little bit tougher, or it may make a lot of sense, but oh boy, there's something else going on that's more glittery in life.
There's a lot of noise and glitter. And in this particular age, we are subject to it more than most earlier cultures. We read a wonderful poster the other day. We didn't know whether to laugh or to cry. Give up pessimism. It won't work anyway.
That's good.
It's wonderful, but therefore it's horrible. We so easily portion our time to things that we think are necessary. And for most of us, the last thing on our necessary list is ourselves and our inner growth. We may take care of our physical health. We may go to the gym 3 times a week. Do we go to the spiritual gym 3 times a week? Once a week? 1 hour a week? We need to have a plan that touches our inner nature, because we are not this personal being. We're a reincarnating ego, a spiritual being using substance that sacrifices itself for us. And we get into a wonderful mystical subject here. We think, all right, Atma Buddhi Manas, spirit, spiritual intellection, and mind. Those are the higher principles. Those are the higher spiritual faculties. But the lower are the exact same thing with manas in germ. The metaphor is used that it's like the front and the back. It's all one thing. Then your physical body, your personal nature, your lower nature is lower only in the scale of use. It is as spiritual, as meaningful as the thinker, but it has taken a lower position. It is intelligence that is allowing the thinker to have experience. And it is because of that sacrifice that the intelligence in those lower kingdoms works its way up into the human form when it is joined with the thinker, and then that's an initiation. That lower has become the embodiment of the higher. So we have to rethink everything. We have to treat our body with respect and gratitude. And at the same time, we treat all of life in the same way, to the extent we're able to do it. One of the problems we usually have is, as beginners, we're super critical about our failure with these ideas. Well, that's silly. You didn't super criticize yourself in grade school or when you were learning the alphabet. You may have been frustrated. We recall we were the only student left in our class that could not tie her shoes. Just could not do it. And you feel very critical of yourself. What's wrong with me? Well, what's wrong with me is I couldn't tie my shoes. Not that I'm stupid. And yet we do. We build up a critical case against ourselves when we should just be taking notes. This, if I look at this, it should help me to understand what I need to learn, what I need to do, who I need to speak with to help me clarify these ideas. You spoke earlier about the overwhelming, changing the premises of things. We recall an older student saying, take the fundamental propositions and build a frame, just a frame. And the frame is, all life is one, all life operates under law, all life is in the process of growing from within. Now, as you learn something, as you understand something in your life or in the philosophy, put it within that frame and put the next thing. And once you get to the point where two things don't agree with each other, throw the whole thing out and start over. But realize when you have learned what doesn't fit, you have learned something very important. So if we understood ourselves and the process, we would find it fascinating. It is a world we are creating. Yes?
So who ties your shoes now?
Actually, I looked at myself the other day, laughing about that, and I realized I tie backwards. So no wonder I couldn't learn it. So everybody was trying to teach me to do it one way, and I had to do it another way. Yes?
Well, the point being that there's the self-sufficiency that comes really from within outward, and we just need to be patient, and we learn.
Yes.
We learn what we need to learn.
Finally. Just a little personal aside. Our daughter was thrown out of gym class in first grade, and the teacher sent a note saying she can't tie her shoes and we can't wait for her. Not going to get away with that. I know how that feels. So I did her tennis shoes with elastic, tied it, sewed it together, and all she had to do was lift her foot up and put her. And within a year or two, she learned to tie her shoe. And yet, she's very bright. And I should ask her how she ties her shoes today. Yes?
Well, it seems, listening, that that statement, smile your own candid camera.
Oh, that is true,
that
though.
We have to have a sense of humor about ourselves.
Yes?
As you indicated. And it seems then that it gets much, much easier because you don't realize you're understanding it until you say, aha, that's what that means.
Actually, you know, at the moment of genuine death, not, we can't think of the word again, not close to death or someone recovered from when they thought that they were dead, but at the actual death, that's when we realize, smile, you're on candid camera, was absolutely true. Every moment of our entire life, including our dreams, including our peripheral vision, is a visual and audio record that we take in, which is why we are told if you're in the presence of death, 12 hours of silence for the person so that they have an easier time focusing on what is going on in their brain. Yes.
This week, the family had an experience with hospice care, and the instructions were not to stimulate the patient in any way, shape, or form, but don't touch, don't speak, be present, be mindful, be radiant, but allow that entity to begin its transformation.
Oh, that's wonderful. And they just accepted this.
Yes.
Wow. It's there's so many things we have the opportunity now to plan for, including being in the hospital. What are those things called? They ask you if you have one.
Living will.
Living will, that's yes. That you can set up that certain things will not be done so that you will not have a life that is really just something sustained by equipment and doesn't allow the soul to escape. But that's because the worldview we have says, this is it, folks. You get one life. You better make the most of it. You better worry about yourself. Take care of you. Be selfish. It makes perfectly good sense. And as long as you think that way, why shouldn't you act that way? What we know, though, as students of this ancient philosophy, is that that just keeps creating the conditions we see in the world around us. We keep coming back with this selfish notion. And because we have it, we don't ever see, my goodness, how many times have I been here and done the same stupid stuff? It's exhausting. We wanted to ask you how you pronounce the German word worldview. We know it's Welt, Welt. Huh?
Weltblick.
I can't hear you.
Zeitgeist.
Huh?
No, that's a spirit.
It's something like Weltspanglung something. Okay.
Weltanschauung.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Weltanschauung.
Okay. And that's where the expression comes from. You had your hand up.
In addition to having a living will, we should also assign some one or more persons who will act for us.
Mm-hmm. An advocate.
It's called a health power of attorney.
A power.
Set up with your attorney.
Right.
With your lawyer.
And well, and these things are also available online, and I do believe now that hospitals have to ask you if you have them, which is good because it puts people in mind of, yes, I should do this. Although we do know cases where they were not respected, and of course that resulted in lawsuits. Now that's another thing where we have a worldview that says, anything that I don't like that's happened to me, I should get to sue the pants off somebody else. We have more lawyers per square inch in the United States than any other country in the world. We recall a young Vietnamese man who was released from Indiantown Gap and went to live among us normal Americans. And he was so confused. He said, in my country, if you have a problem, the two people go to the oldest person in the village, and whatever they say is the answer is already agreed, that will be the answer. Peace will reign, because peace is more important than the argument. He said, so in Vietnam, we have one lawyer for every 100,000 people. In America, it's closer to one-on-one. He also said, we thought it was one of the wisest things. In America, the more expensive the car you own, the more likely you are to pay someone else to drive it. Huh? We are very strange, we Americans. But that just represents the possibilities. We never stop to think about it, maybe, or appreciate it enough. Look at all our possibilities. Look at the very fact that we are in this town. Look at the people that lived and worked here and created things. Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Paine. They were neighbors. We just maybe were not here at the time, but their influence is still here. If we're sincere, we can pick up influences. Actually, we're told if you spend a lot of time reading Mr. Judge or reading HPB or reading Plato, you literally at times put your own mind, which is not physical, in, here we go with words,
in tune.
In tune. We were going to say in cahoots, but that's not right. In tune with their mind. Can you imagine what a presumptuous thought most people would think that was? You think you can put your mind in communion with Plato's mind. It just means you're vibrating at the same pitch for that moment. And many of us have felt this. You may have felt it in church, in a relationship with someone, that perfect harmony of the moment where you feel you are a million times bigger than yourself because you are part of the other and all others. So these are some of the worldview things we should start grabbing onto. Do I want moments like that? Do I make them happen? That's the question. Yes.
Idea of universal brotherhood, and if we, when we talk about the great heresy of separateness, when one looks at everything that's going on, that to us seems to be the main issue, is that people do think of themselves as separate.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that we see also is that so many radicals think that their God is the only God. And again, they're looking at an outside God. And these issues, we just seem to see that they are the main ideas for the...
And where do they come from? Those ideas come from our desires. It isn't that we desire to be separate, it's that that's what we see. I'm here, I'm separate, you're there, you're there, you're there. As long as we hold that idea, then we have the desire to protect our separateness in any way we can, either joining together with those who think like we do, or somebody who promises to protect us. So it all begins with a desire. And if we could learn to trust life, that we really are one big family, one universe of life. And that's the other realization. Because we are life itself, nothing can destroy us. There's no such thing as death. There's the death of the body. There's the death of our conditions and circumstances. But we, as thinkers, persist, waiting for the assimilation of what we've just been through so that we can move on from there, which we could do more quickly if we'd try assimilating every day, digesting and reasoning and understanding what we've done, where we've been, where we're going. But the tragedy of the world, when we look at it, remember, those are old karmas working themselves out. Many involved in the situation may be ready to separate from it, but the power of the force behind them is so great they can't at the moment. So we can watch transitions. We can watch changes happening across the world, and they're from individuals altering the way they're thinking and behaving, but it takes many individuals to change the course of a large group, of a nation or a religion. But it will happen because we are mind beings. The ideas we carry as individuals are percolating and out there and affecting others. If they have even a glimmer of a hope, they will feel it or read it. Yes.
Well, in terms of worldview and theosophy, we think one of the fundamental ideas that we come face to face with is time. Our concept of time has been a certain thing. And then we move into theosophy and it expands beyond our imagination. But that leads to an all, like the past is present and the future is present. You know, like it brings forth a lot of ideas of what really time is. And I think it's one of the fundamental questions that we all grapple. Measurement of time is in the physical realm. We don't know how to measure it in the spiritual realm.
And
or if we can.
Yeah, it's a wonderful question because it just dazzles and rocks your mind. I mean, according to the Mahatmas, there is no such thing as past, present, and future. There is just now. We recall an older student here talking to someone who did not accept the idea of reincarnation. It was ridiculous. And she said to him, "Well, what time is it?" And he said, "Well, it's now." She said, "Well, you're here now." "Yes." "And what time is it now?" "Well, it's still now." "Well, when is it not now?" "Oh," he said. She said, "If you're here now and you can't tell me when there isn't now, reincarnation must be true." Yes.
This other concept of God being some other being somewhere who will take care of you, which a lot of people just are not willing
to let go.
To let go of that, because they need this heavenly being to pray to and to solve all their problems. And the idea of that divine is in each of us, and that's what ties us all together in this big brotherhood and the now.
But you can understand someone who sincerely believes in that God the Father not wanting to give that up, and they probably won't until an experience lets them down. We recall as a child the first time we really questioned that, because we had a very, very deep reverence for that divine idea, was someone who was interviewed on the radio after being the only person who lived through a tragedy. And the remark, I think it was a bridge collapsed or something, and the gentleman remarked, "God was really with me that day." And we remember getting so angry, because that means that God didn't care about any of the other people. He just let them die. So he may have felt it, but we think he should have kept it to himself. But from then on, we realized there's something wrong with this idea. But we understand why somebody would cling to it. It's a scary world if you don't have the knowledge of the principles that underlie life. If you don't know that there's no such thing as death, and yet you know it, you see it in nature. You see that the flowers die in the winter and come back in the spring. You see it with the trees. You see it with all kinds of things, that there is a life that is persistent, that doesn't require the form, that continues when the form is not available to it. So if you don't have that worldview, if you don't have those ideas to stretch your own mind and your own capacity, it is understandable why somebody would be dependent on that God idea. And remember, many religions are made to keep that idea alive. We're not saying that the people are being cynical in doing it. We have no way of knowing that. But we do know that people are forced to become more and more dependent. And yet, look at the sincere people who have lived on that basis and done incredible, beautiful things. It's just a doorbell. Although, you know, that's not a bad thing. I think maybe we all have to come up with a sort of doorbell for ourselves. If something would just wake us up every so often, wouldn't that be wonderful? Maybe we could set our cell phones to an alarm, and when the alarm goes off at 3:15, you know, aha, I'm supposed to think about the first fundamental. Maybe we could do that for ourselves. After all, we are minds in evolution, and nobody can force us, change us, make us do anything but we ourselves. I remind you that Wednesday night we have a study class in the ocean, and on next Sunday we have the Gateway to Self-Knowledge, which is what this whole class has been a preface for. Meeting is adjourned.